From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The war on terror, the likely closure of the Guantanamo Bay prison camp, investigations of whether illegal activities helped trigger the financial crisis. The Attorney General is the chief law enforcement officer in the United States. Whoever gets that job in the next administration is going to be plenty busy. So what do we know at this point about how the two campaigns are thinking about their legal strategies? In a few minutes, we talk to George Terwilliger, a legal advisor to the McCain campaign. But now we're joined by Eric Holder. He was a deputy attorney general during the Clinton administration. Now he's a senior advisor and senior legal counsel to the Obama campaign. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me on the show.
So we're less than 2 weeks away from Election Day, and both sides in this campaign have assembled an army of lawyers to help prepare for a possible contested election. Hopefully not. 5,000 lawyers in Florida alone will reportedly be on hand looking out for the Obama campaign's interests. So What sort of challenges is your team preparing for?
Well, I mean, we're preparing for the worst and hoping for the best. We're hoping that there will not be anything by way of voter suppression efforts where people will be challenged unnecessarily or where impediments will be placed in front of people who want to exercise their rights to vote. The campaign has gotten out a substantial number of people who are voting for the first time. We've energized people who have not voted in a great while. These are people who might not be as familiar with their rights as voters, and we want to make sure that everybody who wants to get there has an opportunity to vote. And that's why we've been emphasizing that people in the 31 states that allow it actually get out there and vote early.
Now, you served as Deputy Attorney General during the Clinton administration, and your name has been listed as a possibility for Attorney General in an Obama administration, if there is one. If that happens, if he's elected, and if you're offered the position, would you take it?
I think that's we're getting way, way in front of ourselves. I mean, at this point, my only concern is making sure that Tuesday, November the 4th, goes well and that we have a result that I think the majority of the American people are going to be very happy with, and that is that Barack Obama becomes the next president of the United States and really changes the course of this country. And at that point, it'll be up to the president to decide what he wants to do with his cabinet, and decisions will be made at that point.
Take us inside the campaign for 1 second. Is there a sense Senator Obama has been looking out for his own family, his grandmother's ailing? Is there a sense of urgency right now that everything that you've had to do to prepare is all going to be put in play at any moment? And do you feel ready?
Yeah, we feel ready. We think that we have planned for, you know, all the contingencies that we can anticipate, and then we've tried to figure out what are those things that, you know, what are the kind of off-the-wall things that we might have to deal with. Barack is, as you said, going to be in Hawaii for at least a couple of days to see his grandmother, a woman who he cares obviously a great deal about. But while he's gone, the rest of us are still here preparing, making sure that we are successful in our get-out-the-vote effort, making sure that we encourage people to vote early, and making sure that for those people who vote on November the 4th, they'll have the opportunity to cast their votes. People are going to have to wait in lines. I don't think there's any question about that. I suspect we're going to see record numbers of voters, and so people are going to have to be patient. But our hope is that everybody who wants to vote will get that opportunity to do so in a way that is least burdensome to them.
Okay, a policy point. You have been outspoken about the need, in your opinion, to close the Guantanamo Bay prison camps without delay.
Right.
Why are you advocating for that? And what other issues do you see as top issues for this country to deal with?
Well, I think Guantanamo, the utility of Guantanamo has long since passed. It is a place now that has given, I think, this nation a black eye around the world. It has an impact on our ability to interact with our allies. It certainly gives fuel to our adversaries who would say that we are a nation that is not governed by law. And so I think the need for it to be closed and to come up with alternatives is pretty clear. And then when you look at the other issues that I think the next president is going to have to deal with, chief among them is going to be trying to revitalize and remake a Justice Department that has been really sullied in the last 4-8 years or so by people who tried to politicize it. And I want to make very clear, I am excluding the present attorney general, who I think is doing a good job, and as well as the people who served as deputy attorneys general, who I think have done a good job. But other people at the Justice Department have not necessarily done what has always happened under Republican and Democratic administrations, where the department has essentially been seen as something not political and really kind of left to its own. That was not the case in this past administration.
All right. Last question, briefly. What role should the Attorney General play in unraveling what happened during the financial crisis or the build-up to this financial crisis?
Well, I think some really intense, vigorous investigation needs to be done to see if any laws were broken. We're facing the greatest economic calamity since the Great Depression, and to the extent people have done anything either by fraud, conspiracy, or broken any federal laws, I think that needs to be uncovered, and people need to be held accountable. The United States taxpayers, people, are going to be paying substantial amounts of money for a good many years in order to make this thing better and to, you know, prevent this thing from getting worse. And to the extent that people have profited illegally or done things illegally, they need to be found out and they need to be prosecuted. And I think that should be a priority for the next Attorney General.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Eric Holder, senior advisor and senior legal counsel to the Obama campaign. He was also a former deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration. And now we're going to turn to a legal advisor to the McCain campaign. George Terwilliger is a former deputy attorney general in the George H.W. Bush administration. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So we were just talking a little bit with Eric Holder about financial issues, and one of the things that you did was take a look at, through the Financial Fraud Task Force at, you know, basically this question of what is a fair application of government statutes to the financial industry, including credit liens and these other incidents where things went badly wrong. So from that perspective, having that experience, what is the role of the Attorney General in taking a look at what's been going on these past months?
Well, I think the primary role will really belong, and the emphasis belongs, on economic recovery rather than retribution. But clearly, part of the recovery ought to be understanding exactly what happened. And if fraud and fraudulent activity played a role in it, then that squarely falls within the jurisdiction of the Justice Department to not only ferret it out, but to address it where justice requires.
Now, we've been talking also about possible legal strategies for dealing with the election, and you actually led the legal team for then-candidate George W. Bush in the 2000 recount. So what challenges now are you preparing for in this election with this team if things become tense or tight or contested on Election Day?
Well, I think what we're preparing for is to, if necessary, once again, see the rule of law prevail and to have, in the great American political tradition, any dispute about elections or voting settled in the way that the law provides and not with people in the streets. It was amazing to me how many of my colleagues who were around the world said to me that people in other countries, particularly less developed countries, were amazed that in a matter of such great controversy, when the justices finally decided, the people accepted the rule. Here, I think there are some other issues in play. I was a little disappointed to hear Eric say during your interview, and I'll note that Eric is a friend of mine and someone that I professionally admire a great deal. But I was a little disappointed to hear him put the emphasis on voter suppression. Nobody wants to see votes suppressed, of course. But we've heard an awful lot about allegations of fraudulent registrations. And unfortunately, Senator Obama seems to have, in the comments he's made about it, made light of it. I would hope that Senator Obama and his lawyers, rather than write the Justice Department and tell them to stand down, would be encouraging the Justice Department to ferret out false registrations, which can become false votes. Because if there is a false vote, then the vote of every legitimate voter is diluted, and the very heart of the franchise of democracy is threatened.
How do you make a decision when to contest a vote? I mean, 2000 was special in every way. I mean, there was nothing typical about it, but there hasn't been a lot that's been typical about this race either. So under what circumstances would you decide, we think that there's been enough fraud in this election to go ahead and contest certain states or certain votes?
I don't think sort of hypothesizing about what the threshold for a lawful election contest might be is on our radar screen at all. I think what's more important right now is that the state election officials, who many of whom are volunteers, by the way, in the polling places on election day, are given the tools they need to separate legitimate votes from those that are votes coming from people for whatever reason and for whatever candidate trying to game the system. Because, as I said, that just dilutes the importance of every legitimate vote, and it challenges the very framework of our democracy.
One last thing, and also briefly, issue of Guantanamo. I brought that up with Mr. Holder. Is that a priority for what would be a McCain administration if it is elected?
Yes. You know, Senator McCain, particularly given his own experience in the military, believes very strongly that the United States has to lead the world in how we deal with people that have to be detained. And he has made it clear that he would close Guantanamo Bay as a prison and move to a different system to adjudicate the responsibility of people who are involved in or planning terrorist acts.
Well, Mr. Terwilliger, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
That was George Terwilliger, legal advisor to the McCain campaign. He is also a former deputy attorney general in the administration of former President George H.W. Bush. And just ahead, do voters care more about personality than issues? That's next in our month-long series on voting. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. How do we decide who to vote for in an election? Is it about how much you think a candidate is going to raise your taxes, or because you have a gut feeling about their character? We continue our month-long series on voting with a look at voter psychology and campaign messaging. In a few minutes, we're going to talk to a pollster and a policy analyst. But joining us now to talk about the psychology of voting, we've got Robert Luskin. He's an associate professor of communication at Stanford University and a research advisor for the Center for Deliberative Democracy. Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, how are you?
Good. All right. So list a few different factors that make a difference in how people vote.
Well, of course, excuse me, there are policy issues, how you see the candidates in relation to your own policy preferences. There's retrospective judgments about how well or poorly things are going in the country. There's the reactions to the candidates as people, and there's party affiliation.
Do we have any sense of what's the most important?
Well, these things are difficult to sort out, but I think it's fair to say, reading over the studies of the matter, that at least in recent decades, the candidates' personalities have probably been the single most important factor.
One of the things we've taken a look at on our show is how personalities or perceived personalities play out in the age of television and blogs and this relentless onslaught of updates about what people look like, whether they're making a funny face, whether they made a gaffe. Has the perception of candidates or how you judge even those feelings that you have for a candidate changed because of how the media has changed?
What sort of change in the media do you have in mind?
The rapidity with which we see candidates' images change. You know, one day you'll see one speech live. You might see another speech by the same candidate live the same day. You'll see a blog post with images sometimes that look mocking of a candidate. That is not the case with what elections used to be like, where candidates were given a little more leeway to seem a little more presidential even before they were elected.
I'm not sure if that's had much effect. What has had a long-term effect is the penetration of society by television and information about what the candidates are like, or at least what they appear to be like, their personae on television, is now readily available, whereas decades ago it wasn't. And that's had an influence in raising the level of impact for candidate personalities.
Are people comfortable really talking to researchers about what they think? Are people honest?
Oh, I think they're generally honest. They're not necessarily that insightful. There's quite a bit of literature in psychology to suggest that people are actually not very good at knowing themselves what processes have led them to given choices.
Okay. When you take a look at this election, is there anything that stands out that's different from, say, 4 years ago, 8 years ago, 12 years ago, in terms of how people are making a selection of their candidate, or are the trends pretty much the same?
Well, I think the broad factors are the same. That is, there are a number of more minor influences, but the big influences on vote choice can be put under the headings I listed earlier. And I don't know that they're carrying greatly different weights either. But what has changed is how those factors are militating in this election. So in this election, of course, people see the Times as very bad. A lot of people are unhappy with American foreign policy, with the war in Iraq in particular. Still more so, a lot of people are worried about the economy and see the Bush administration as responsible for the current economic crisis. So on those counts and a few others, there is very widespread dissatisfaction with the Bush administration. So what I described earlier as retrospective judgments are running very heavily anti-Bush, which means, since he is the Republican candidate, also anti-McCain.
Well, Professor, thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
That was Robert Luskin, Associate Professor of Communication and Research Advisor at the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University. He joined us from the studios at Stanford University. And we're continuing the discussion on what drives voters with David Basaitis, a senior policy analyst for the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. It's good to have you on the show again.
Thank you.
All right. You released a national opinion poll on African Americans' attitudes in the election. So what are the primary motivators specifically for black voters this election?
I would say the dominant motivator is a dissatisfaction and unease with the economy. The economy is by far the number one issue. Almost 10 times as many African Americans mention the economy as any other issue. And they say 55% say that they're doing worse financially than they were doing a year ago.
Now, there's an assumption by some people that really this race is much more about race. Is there can you say that people are voting based on the economy and then also factor how race influences their voting patterns as well?
I think it is.
And I mean the race of the candidate, not
right.
Their race.
I'll speak first about African Americans. There are conservatives who suggest that African Americans vote solely based upon race, or that they vote solely based because of the Democratic Party. But African Americans don't vote solely based upon race. There have been many black candidates, including for governor and for United States senator, who African Americans have vigorously opposed. There are majority black congressional districts that are represented by white members of Congress. Gary, Indiana, a city that's almost 90% black during the 90s, had a white mayor. African Americans vote mainly on issues because the black population has, on average, lower incomes and much, much less in the way of assets than the white population. And so they don't have the luxury to be voting on what many of them would consider frivolous reasons. They have to get down to the things that are really important, and that's the economy.
Now, your study found that Barack Obama is viewed favorably by African Americans, but Bill Clinton had the highest favorable rating ever. So do you think that was based on his personality, his record, his perceived record, which is sometimes not the same as what the actual record is? Why do you think that was the case?
I'll tell you exactly what that was based upon. I just mentioned that in the survey I just released, 8% of African Americans said they were doing financially better than they were doing a year ago, and 55% said they were doing worse. When I asked that same question in 2000, at the end of Bill Clinton's second term, 45% of African Americans said they were doing better, and 10% said they were doing worse. And Bill Clinton mentioned, and this is from government economic statistics, that in his second term, African-American households made $5,000 more than they had made previously. That's a big increase over a four-year period of time, household income increasing by $5,000, more than what white household income had increased over that four-year period of time on average. And Bill Clinton's fabulous favorability rating in the fall of 2000 was a reflection of that.
When you've been doing this kind of work for quite some time, what can you say about the addition of new voters, non-traditional voters from the African-American community into the mix? How do you think that's going to throw off, first of all, the work of people like you, but also in general things like exit polls or you know, these last-minute pre-election polls?
Well, one of the problems with turnout that the African-American community has had for a long time was low turnout among younger African-Americans. That's also true of whites, young white people and young Hispanic people as well. But the African-American population is a lot younger than the white population. About half of the African-American population is younger than 31 years old, whereas to get half of the white population, you have to go to about 41 or 42 years old. So the black population is much younger. And that low turnout by younger African-Americans depressed black turnout overall. And this year, with the enormous enthusiasm that younger voters, including younger black voters, have for Senator Obama's campaign and his candidacy, I think there's going to be a big upturn in the number of African and percentage of African-Americans who vote in this election, because finally the sort of weak link in black turnout in elections is being remedied. Some of the polls have taken account of this. Gallup is releasing its tracking survey now with two versions, with a version with their traditional likely voter screen, which essentially discounts people who've never voted before in their polling calculations, and a voting screen that probably is more accurate reflection of what's happening right now, mm-hmm. which takes into consideration that there is going to be a big increase in turnout by younger voters, including younger African Americans. And consistently, Senator Obama is runs 3 to 4 points ahead of what he does with a traditional voter screen than with this new voter screen.
Well, David, thank you.
You're welcome.
That was David Bisaitis, Senior Policy Analyst for the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and he joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now we've got Frank Luntz, a political consultant and a pollster and a Fox News contributor. How you doing, Frank?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not calling you from a studio. I'm calling you from a telephone right near LAX. So at least I've got the most exotic location.
You are not that far from us, and yet you're on the phone. But next time you have to come by our studios. But anyway, you have been someone who has pioneered so many things in polling, including really certain types of focus groups and people metering and dealing with swing voters. What are you seeing this time around?
Well, it's interesting because I had the opportunity to hear your two previous guests, and they are experts in what they do, But in the work that I've done, I'm not sure if I would agree necessarily with what they've said. The partisan voters absolutely vote on issues. They vote on substances. What makes them partisan? And the more ideological you are, the more concerned you are about issues. But there's about 40% of Americans, and that number is growing with every election cycle, that becomes less partisan, more independent, less ideological, more centrist. And those are people who are voting on the attributes and the character traits of the candidates rather than the issues. And in fact, because they take bits and pieces from both political parties, they don't want to be pigeonholed, and they look at the attributes. Can the candidate deliver what they say they're going to do? And that's it, this trend has been taking place ever since 1992.
So this time around, what are people who are either first-time voters, non-traditional voters, or swing voters? And I realize those are overlapping but not the same. What are they looking for?
I'll give you the two things they're looking for more than anything else. And one of them is where Barack Obama has the advantage, and the other one's still up for grabs with 10 days to go. Change is what younger voters are looking for, and that's the word that they use. And they're looking for the most non-traditional candidate, the least political candidate, the person who speaks their language and seems to empathize and represent how they think, how they feel, and can talk to them in their language. But the other thing they're looking for is accountability. It's one of the reasons why younger voters, non-traditional voters, are most angry with Wall Street, most ticked off with the economic system as we have, and bitter about Washington, is because they feel that the guys on top, the people who are running things, aren't held accountable for the things that they do. And so this is an angry component of the electorate, and this is a component that doesn't want things the way they've been. They want things to be really different going forward.
When you think about the work that you've done this election and being able to deal with people, you know, in different contexts and different types of polling, how good do you think polls are this time around when there are any number of X factors in this election?
Well, it drives me nuts because I get from, and I work for a news organization, and so I'm collecting information from all different sides, and everyone sends around the poll that makes their candidate look the best as though it's ammunition. And the whole purpose of measuring public opinion is not to make one candidate or another look good. It's to understand how people actually feel and how they think. I don't believe that telephone polling necessarily reports to the exact percentage of what people think and how they feel, because there is a little bit of a socialized factor or a Bradley factor, as people have talked about. And I don't believe you can get it from face-to-face interviews either, because people react differently depending on who's doing the interviewing, and I don't think even internet polling necessarily gets into the detail that you need. You actually need to combine all three methodologies to have an accurate understanding of how people feel and how they think.
Very quickly, just give us a sense of whether negative campaigning is more effective than positive campaigning.
Good question, and my answer is that one reason why Barack Obama is doing as well as he is right now is because he's resisted it to the greatest degree. His speech at the convention was more positive than McCain's, his debate performances more hopeful than McCain's, and while it's unclear what lead he has, I think one reason why he has a lead is that his campaign is perceived as being more hopeful, more optimistic, and more focused on the future and less focused on the past. And I think that accounts for why Obama has been doing so well up to this point.
Well, Frank, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Frank Luntz is a political consultant and pollster. He's also a Fox News contributor. And next on News and Notes, is hip-hop still a man's world? We'll ask that question to female rap pioneer Spinderella and Yo-Yo. Plus, we hear from you in letters. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. How will Americans bring their individual experiences with race into the voting booth? It's a question National Public Radio has been trying to understand. There's an ongoing series of discussions with a group of 15 voters from diverse racial backgrounds in York, Pennsylvania. Here's a sample.
I don't know if I can see another old white man as president I don't think there's to be a problem with a black man. I personally just don't think Obama's the right one.
But what would make you think Palin would be?
Right now, McCain is the man. The only way you are no longer a Muslim is if you are dead.
I'm going to vote for Obama. And one of my reasons is because he is black.
NPR's series on race is a collaboration between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. It's anchored by Steve Inskeep and Michelle Norris. And Michelle joins us now. How are you?
Hey, Farai.
So you've said you often leave discussions about race thinking there was so much left unsaid. So first of all, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's a difficult topic. I mean, people usually sort of skirt around the edges. It's laden with all kinds of emotion. People feel pain, people feel guilt, people feel confusion. And as journalists, we often sit down and talk to people in 15, 20 minute, maybe half hour chunks. And it's hard to peel away all those emotions in a short period of time. And so the idea for these series of conversations is just that, is that it would be a series of conversations that we would go back time and time again to help people get into their comfort zone, get comfortable with each other, get comfortable with us, and spend a good deal of time with them. These conversations, we've now had two. We spoke to this group of voters in September, and we're just there recently in October. And each of these conversations lasted 3 hours. And they began with a good meal. We thought food was an important part of this. And what we realized is that it takes time for people to not just get comfortable, but to get courageous so that they'll say things that sometimes are impolitic, sometimes are offensive. And I'm convinced that in both of our conversations with these voters that we got to a place that we wouldn't have reached if we just sat down for 15 or 20 minutes or even an hour. It took a lot of time to really peel away those layers.
I remember one moment where you're asking, when do you think about race? And someone said, right now. Like, you know, because, hey, we're on the spot. At certain points, people are accused, people in the media, of overemphasizing our differences. Were they afraid of being misrepresented?
Some were and some weren't. There was a lawyer who participates in the discussions. He is a registered Republican. And when the local paper did a story about our series of conversations, they identified him as a white Republican. And he said when he saw that in the paper, it was jarring for him because he never thought of himself being described in that way. He said, I've never just thought of myself of having a label affixed to my name. And it was really uncomfortable for me. And when he was saying this, there were several people in the color in the room who were nodding their heads saying, well, welcome to our world.
Speaking of welcome to our world, One thing I've noticed is that, you know, we talk about black folks, we talk about white folks. There's no question that you have to talk about blackness. But you've also included people who are not black and not white. So how do you think Latinos and Asians in particular are faring in this election in terms of feeling represented or sought out or given their say?
The Latinos thought that their issues have been somewhat overlooked. And broadly, when we talk about race in America, that discussion is so often about blacks and whites. And that was, you know, that's striking because if we think back to when Barack Obama in Pennsylvania, by the way, delivered that important speech on race, he cast it primarily in black and white terms. He mentioned Latinos or Hispanics, but it was really only in passing reference. And as for people who are Muslim or are from the Arab world or are from South Asia, they really feel, at least based on the experiences of Muhammad Khan, who was in the room, that this is sort of an ancillary issue for them, that when they are included in the discussion, it's often in a very painful way because of the way that the word Muslim has been co-joined or linked to the word terrorist. There are several people in the room that are either the product of mixed marriages, involved in mixed marriages, have mixed marriages within their immediate family. And so the whole notion of multiculturalism was something that was it was a real focus of the second discussion that we had, not just the black and white issue, but what it means to be multicultural and how people define themselves, how the world defines them. The question that we often get from our listeners, Barack Obama is often described as being black or African American. People will write in and tell us, but wait a minute, isn't he multicultural? Why aren't we saying that? Why do we call him black? And why don't we, and we do call him black, aren't we ignoring or downplaying his white heritage as well?
Well, Michelle, it's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Farai, it's been great to be with you.
Michelle Norris is co-host of NPR's All Things Considered. She joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. You can hear all of the installments of NPR's series on race. Just go to our website at npr.org. And their next trip to York is on November 11th, right after the election. Now that hip-hop has been around for decades, are women getting more or less attention than they did when the art form started? With us today is Yo-Yo, a boundary-breaking rapper plus Spinderella, the DJ who's a member of the legendary group Salt and Peppa. They both took part in BET's 2008 Hip-Hop Awards. They air tonight. Hi, ladies.
How are you?
I am doing great. It's great to have you on. And so the awards air tonight, and you take us back to the day.
So if you're here, back, cooling by day, then at night, working up a sweat. Come on, girls, let's go show the guys that we know how to become number one in a hot body show. Now push it.
Yo-Yo is dancing in her seat. That's a good sign. So, Spin, it's great to have you back on. We had so much fun when you were here before.
Yeah, how have you been?
Things are great. So, you know, it's amazing to think that Push It was released 2 decades ago.
I know, you're reminding me now, like,
that's, you
seems
know,
like it was just yesterday.
Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, how do you think, why do you think that that song stands up today?
I think it's because the subliminal message in it. A lot of people, we always talk about this when we're performing, how some people think it's about sex. Some might think it's about dancing, but I think it's that subliminal message, you know, that classic, I wonder, you know, what people are thinking. And it's been years that has been really, really the issue with that song. Also, the fact that it's up-tempo, and it's just like...
It's a classic.
It's perfect for right now. You know, like, if you're hearing the music right now, a lot of the music that is out in R&B and hip-hop, up-tempo stuff is reflecting of that sound.
I want to go to Yo-Yo. Your career took off back in 90 with the song you did with Ice Cube. Here's a little bit of it. So, another great song, another set of memories. When you think about that moment in hip-hop, what makes it different from today?
Introduction. It was just, I think there's just, it's the same. There's only a few then, there's only a few now. And the Salt and Pepper song, I think that song is a classic. It just reminds you of the introduction of women realizing that they had a place in hip-hop. For me, that's why that song is just, so I could see the video, I could see it there. And for me, with You Can't Play With My Yo-Yo, same thing. I think it was just an introduction, another style, West Coast style of female MCs doing their things, and that, you know, it was just very few of us then.
Salt and Peppa rolled out with 3 women.
Yeah.
And you, when you collaborated with a guy, you used a different mechanism to sort of enter the public consciousness. What's the difference in your mind between, say, if you had, you know, come out completely solo without having kind of this archangel figure versus working with him?
It wouldn't have been the same. I mean, because I think we all come out of camps. Salt and Pepper had Herbie Lovebug, who had introduced him to the game. I had Ice Cube, who really, I was the voice for women at that time, because women were being talked about so bad within those lyrics, so that it was just it was like the answer. It was almost like when Latifah said, "Who you calling a bitch?" Just a little bit sooner.
Well, we cannot use those words on NPR, but we will just forge ahead because we're so nice here. But I want to go back to the award show. You ladies dedicated the performance of What a Man to Barack Obama, and it also, you know, it's Yo-Yo, Lady of Rage, MC Light. What was that moment like? I'm going to start with you, Spin. What was that performance like?
Well, of course, we're all friends, and a lot of people seem to think that, you know, because you're females in hip-hop, that it's catty and this, that, and the other. But we've supported each other. Each of us have supported each other in some way prior to that. But when we got together, it was kind of that first time that we actually had the opportunity to be on stage, work with each other. We actually rehearsed together. We came up with ideas. And the show you'll see later on, we all had collectively brought something to the table with that. So it was a good... It was a really good feeling, and to portray that on the stage, we felt the energy. See, it was like, you know, you didn't know what to expect. You knew it would be good, but when we did it, it was very empowering, and that was exactly what we were trying to get across.
And Yo-Yo, you know, it strikes me that you have had a voice that transcends hip-hop performance. You've also done stuff on the radio where you get to talk a lot, use your own voice outside of the performance mode. But there must be a certain juice that you get from performing. What is it like to just, you know, take the stage?
It's a different kind of energy. I've been a performer all my life. I was in proficiency in English programs, drama, art. So to be on stage, it's just really giving my soul. It's really giving my energy, it's giving love through performing. Not necessarily what I'm saying, it's connecting to a people through music, through energy. I love it.
Do you ever worry that the music, as you loved it or as you started out in it, has gotten too rough for girls? You know, I mean, I think that those of us who love hip hop, and I consider myself one of them, I think that what a 15-year-old might hear in hip-hop today is different from what a 15-year-old would listen to when you know, I was one. What do you make of that?
I think that hip-hop has not been allowed to grow up. I think that it's not getting better, it's getting better in different aspects of the word getting better. When you think about getting music getting better and broadening and it being here, hip-hop here to stay, for sure, we know that now. But I think that hip-hop has not been able to grow up. A lot of people are still saying they're still just mirroring what they see. It's past that point. Now you can become more creative. You could use your artistic side and perform music now.
And just really quickly, Spin, do you see more opportunities coming up for women? Real quick.
Of course, as always. I think women need to really take advantage of the moment, the lack of females that are mainstream right now, allows for someone out there to come and just snatch it up. And that's kind of like with the artists that mm-hmm. we know of, like a Yo-Yo, like a Salt-N-Pepa, Latifah, MC Light. We've done that. And the reason why is because, not just because having a good team with us or whatever, but it's like that aggressiveness. You just have to have it.
Well, guys, it's a perfect note to end on. I want to thank you so much. And that was DJ Spinderella of Salt-N-Pepa, also of the radio show The Backspin, and rapper Yo-Yo, who joined us here at NPR West. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How's it going?
Fabulously. So what are folks saying this week?
As you can guess, we got a lot of letters about politics this week. First off, a listener wrote in who didn't like our blogger's discussion about the Bradley effect. That's basically the phenomenon where voters tell pollsters they are supporting a black candidate and then switch their vote on election day. Mari Lautinen in Cupertino, California, wrote us this. I was upset to hear you discuss whether Obama would be hurt by the Bradley effect. The number of donations he's received from voters of all races and backgrounds argues strongly that he will match or exceed his poll numbers. It's 26 years later, things have changed, and Bradley was nowhere near as popular as Obama is.
Then Barbara Silverberg, who listens to us on WHYY in Philadelphia, sent us this. I have been horrified by this presidential campaign from the primaries forward. Please help me to understand how any of our candidates can justify raising millions of dollars to secure the presidency. Change could have begun now. One possibility would be to give half of every dollar raised to food banks or schools in the state where it was raised.
Then last week, we produced a segment on how third-party candidates were affecting the presidential race. Daniel Rosenfield in Dallas, Texas, thanked us for interviewing Libertarian candidate Bob Barr. He writes, "Bob Barr rarely receives any media attention, and you guys have given new hope for third parties. In this election year, where third parties are reaching new voter records, it is important to educate the people of America."
Listener Kevin Smith wrote in about an interview you did with comedian David Alan Greer about his new Comedy Central show, Chocolate News. He thinks Greer's comedy is funny, but too often crosses the line. He writes, "When people like me stop laughing and point this out, we're called uptight. No, I want to laugh like everyone else, but I don't want to do it at the expense of our dignity and progress. I'm sorry, but we're not in the same position as whites who wield power in this country. They can afford to satirize their leaders and ancestors. We can't. Leave Maya Angelou and MLK and the like alone."
And finally, Laura Tillman in Athens, Georgia, wrote us this. "I moved to Georgia last year from Vermont and was really happy to discover the NPR News and Notes program, which brought a perspective that was lacking from my old Vermont NPR station. However, I sometimes feel that the shows are a little rushed. Other than that, I thoroughly enjoy the show and thank you for a job well done. And thank you for your letters. Please keep your comments coming."
Now NPR has a new way to chime in on our stories. Go to our program page at nprnewsandnotes.org and click on a segment. You can click on the comments link and write us your thoughts, and we have plenty of pre-election coverage.
And you can still send us your gripes and praises by logging onto npr.org and clicking on Contact Us. Be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. Check out our website at nprnewsandnotes.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we look at the role of community organizing in getting out the vote. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.